Detta föredrag tillhandahålls av Teofil, som är en evangelikal teologiförening som verkar för en förnyad frimodighet över Kristus och Bibeln. För mer information om oss, besök www.teofil.nu.
Yeah, there we go. All right, now we're entering into a new phase of our study after looking at these three major areas of history, literature, and theology. We're now going to start looking at individual books or topics, beginning with a series of three talks on wisdom literature, beginning with Proverbs, and then moving to Ecclesiastes, and then also we're going to be studying the Song of Songs. And so while we're looking at these books, we're going to be applying some of the principles that we talked about this afternoon. Not all of them all the time, and sometimes I won't make explicit connections, but we'll see important considerations concerning genre and poetic conventions and biblical theology and so forth. Probably in the wisdom section, the issues of history quite aren't as pressing. You know, wisdom literature is not as deeply embedded in history as, say, in the Exodus and so forth. But then after we finish looking at these three topics, and of course we're only doing one tonight, you'll be glad to know, then tomorrow we'll look at a couple issues connected with history and theology, namely the Holy War theme, Divine Warrior, and the Exodus in terms of the Exodus as a historical event. So with that, let me say that I'm planning again to speak for about 45 minutes, and then I'll take your questions. I don't think we're going to go to 8 o'clock. I think, you know, we'll have a good discussion, and we'll leave a little early so you can come back tomorrow refreshed, and I can too. I'm the one with jet lag. All right, now, okay, so how do we rightly interpret the book of Proverbs in terms of its genre and in terms of its theology? And actually, you know, one of the questions is, does Proverbs have a theology? Because wisdom literature tends to be thought of in some circles as some kind of secular, non-religious literature. And often, even in the conservative churches, the book of Proverbs is treated as simply so much good practical advice. You know, and you can isolate certain proverbs, and they don't seem religious at all. A wise son brings joy to his father, a foolish son brings grief to his mother, Proverbs 10, verse 1. That doesn't seem particularly religious on the surface of it. Or a couple of verses later, it says, lazy people are soon poor. Hard workers get rich, which, again, doesn't seem particularly religious or theological. Also, one might question whether it's true at all. You know, is it true that lazy people are soon poor? In the United States, we have a celebrity that unfortunately is probably known globally. Her name is Paris Hilton. Okay, is she known over here in Sweden at all? She's notoriously lazy and fabulously wealthy, you know, so because her grandfather started the Hilton Hotels. And, you know, hard workers get rich. I'll bet some of you work really hard, and you might not think of yourself as particularly wealthy. So is it even true to say that? Okay, now, and that'll be a question of genre. So let's approach the subject this way. Let's ask, what is Proverbs trying to do? Well, and to answer that question, we should look at the preface of the book, chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. Proverbs is that rare book that has a preface, and we'll see that the preface will talk about to whom the book is addressed, about the subject, and so forth. It says, "These are the Proverbs of Solomon, David's son, king of Israel. Their purpose is to teach people wisdom and discipline, to help them understand the insights of the wise. Their purpose is to teach people to live disciplined and successful lives, to help them do what is right, just, and fair. These proverbs give insight to the simple, knowledge and discernment to the young. Let the wise listen to these proverbs and become even wiser. Let those with understanding receive guidance by exploring the meaning in these proverbs and parables, the words of the wise and their riddles." I'm going to stop one verse short of the conclusion to the preamble. I'll come back to it, of course. But on the basis of what I've read so far, it seems that the subject of the book is wisdom, that the purpose is to get its readers to become wise. So let's ask the question, what is wisdom? In the biblical text, wisdom is not the same as intelligence. Wisdom is not measured by IQ tests. Wisdom is more like skill. It's more like knowing how to do something, not knowing facts about something. Indeed, as we get into the book, we'll see that wisdom is connected to the idea of knowing how to do the right thing at the right time, knowing how to say the right thing at the right time. In the States, thanks to a very popular book written about 15 years ago, that has the title Emotional Intelligence. There's a lot of talk about emotional intelligence. I don't know whether you have that same concept over here. It's the idea, as I just described it, of somebody who knows how to navigate life well, and knows what I just said, knows to do the right thing at the right time, say the right thing at the right time, feels the proper emotion that is appropriate for the situation. You know, we talk about people overreacting, you know, showing a lot of anger, inappropriate anger or something. It's not that anger is always wrong. Sometimes it's emotionally intelligent to be angry. You know, if somebody cuts you off on the road, again, this is Sweden, not Los Angeles, but if somebody cuts you off on the road, it's natural and right to feel a little anger that gives you an energy to perhaps respond by giving a warning honk on your horn. I don't know what the custom is over here. But if you're driving in Los Angeles and you cut somebody off, it's very possible that that person will whip around you, put on its brakes, and harass you for the next 10 miles. And it's not unheard of for them to brandish a revolver, you know. So I'm sure that doesn't happen in Sweden. You control your firearms. So that happened to me once, actually, about 2 years ago. I didn't brandish the revolver. It was brandished at me. So in any case, you get the point that emotional intelligence, and it's interesting, in the study of emotional intelligence, it shows something fascinating but sometimes discouraging to very good students, and that is while there is a high correlation between somebody with emotional intelligence, we might also sometimes use the term social skills, and success in life, defined as, you know, ability to get a good job and keep it, the ability to have healthy relationships, enriching relationships, there's actually a low correlation between having a high IQ and those things. Now, let me quickly say to those of you with a high IQ, you can have both. You can have a high IQ and a high emotional intelligence. They're not mutually exclusive. But the point is that that we all know people who are incredibly intelligent but are hard to relate to and would be very difficult to work with because they're so difficult in terms of their personality. And that's what I'm talking about. And so the purpose of the book of Proverbs is not to make people have high IQs, but to know how to navigate life well, to avoid pitfalls, and to maximize success, again, defined by sort of getting ahead in life, having good relationships, etc. But you see, we would be quite wrong to stop at that point in our definition of biblical wisdom, because that's a purely practical category, and a lot of people stop at that point. But we shouldn't, first of all, because of verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. Now, this is a phrase, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, that is repeated a number of times, sometimes with the word wisdom, chokmah in Hebrew. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. So you see, this phrase is saying to the reader that wisdom is not just a practical category, it's a theological category. One cannot even begin to be wise unless one has a proper relationship with God that is characterized by fear. Now, it's interesting to reflect on this word fear and what it means, and why would it be fear rather than, say, love? Well, the type of fear that is talked about here is not the kind of fear that makes you run away. Sometimes you get afraid of something and you head for the hills, but this is the type of fear where your mouth opens up and your knees shake a little bit. Perhaps even a better term would be awe, you know, feeling awe. Respect, some translations that come from the 1960s use the term respect, but that's much too light. Because, you see, the emotion that is being highlighted here is an emotion that is reflecting the idea that you are the creature standing before the Creator. That's the beginning of wisdom, is knowing your place in the universe. You are not the center of the universe. God is. So if you have fear, and this is how this is developed in the book of Proverbs, then you will be humble, not proud. You will look to God for wisdom, and you won't become, as many proverbs warn against, wise in your own eyes. So humility is the proper virtue for the achievement of wisdom, because pride won't let one listen to another, and especially won't listen to people who come up with some kind of correction or criticism. And as the Proverbs, as you read through Proverbs, notice how many times it says the fool doesn't listen to correction, but the wise person does. Again, that's why humility, not pride, is the attitude of the wise person. Okay, so wisdom is a theological concept. This is taught in another, even more interesting, I believe, and pervasive way in the early chapters of Proverbs, and here's where woman wisdom enters in. Woman wisdom is actually a key concept to understanding the book of Proverbs as a whole. In terms of structure, which is a literary observation, we should see that there is a major structural break after chapter 9. So we can talk about two parts of Proverbs, Proverbs 1 to 9 and Proverbs 10 to 31. We can structure the book of Proverbs in other ways as well, but this is an important kind of structural observation, that in chapters 1 to 9, we have a series of speeches or discourses where a father is speaking to his son. Or else, a woman named Wisdom is teaching all the men going by. And then in Proverbs 10 to 31, we have the Proverbs per se, that is, those two-line, maybe sometimes three-line, brief observations, admonitions, or prohibitions. You know, again, lazy people are soon poor, hard workers get rich, etc. That's a proverb. And what we need to see is that we can't read these proverbs in 10 to 31 in an isolated fashion, you know, kind of picking them up. And it's so tempting to do so because, of course, doesn't seem to be any sort of structure of these proverbs. They seem ripe for the proof texting, picking them right out. But we need to read 10 to 31 in the light of 1 to 9, and in particular, looking at the figure of woman wisdom. As you read through Proverbs 1 to 9, you see that there's a major metaphor of life as a path. Everybody is walking on a path. It's one of two types of path. It's either the straight path that's well lit, smooth, and leads to life. Or it's the crooked path with potholes in it and with snares and traps and it's dark. And that path leads to death. Everybody is on a path. But notice something interesting, that as you move toward chapter 9, in chapter 9, everybody who's reading Proverbs, who's on a path, ends up at the foot of a mountain where they hear a female voice. And by the way, before I start talking about what we hear from Woman Wisdom in chapter 9, this is an interesting hermeneutical issue too, because as I just said, Woman Wisdom addresses all the men. The father is speaking to the son. And so we could see that that's pretty typical wisdom literature. We readers, whether we're male or female, whether we're young like the son or more mature like myself, we are to identify with the son. We are the son who's listening to the father and to woman wisdom. This makes it no really different from any other biblical book. You know, when you read a biblical book, you must identify with the original audience first and ask, for instance, they don't call the book of Romans Romans for nothing. You know, it's addressed to the church at Rome. So when you read Romans, you should read it as if you are a member of the Church of Rome, and then ask the question, how does this apply to me today? So the same thing's true with the language in Proverbs. So if I were a woman reader of Proverbs, rather than getting annoyed with the fact that the Proverbs keep repeating something like, better to live in the corner of an attic than in a house with an irritating woman, I would, rather than getting irritated at that, I would read that as a woman saying, better to live in the corner of an attic than in a house with an irritating man. You know, so applying it to my situation, that's how I think we're, first of all, to read it as the son, but then ask, how does that apply to me? Now, it's interesting in the preface. Remember I said the preface the preface says who this book is for. So even though in the book itself it's addressed to young men, in the preface it says, yes, let the young learn, young hear these words and grow wise, but it also says, let the wise hear it and grow even wiser. So the preface broadens the audience. So it's addressed to all of us in the covenant community. We all can learn from it, not just young men. Okay, so as I say, when we come to chapter 9, and you might want to turn with me to Proverbs 9, in verses 1 through 6, we hear about this encounter with wisdom, woman wisdom. It says, woman wisdom has built her house. She's carved its seven columns. She's prepared a great banquet, mixed the wines, and set the table. She has sent her servants to invite everyone to come. She calls out from the heights overlooking the city. Come in with me, she urges the simple. To those who lack good judgment, she says, come eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways behind and begin to live. Learn to use good judgment. So at this pivotal moment, before we hit the Proverbs in chapter 9, we are invited by woman wisdom to share a meal with her. Now, in the ancient Near East, the invitation to share a meal is an invitation to intimate fellowship. Woman wisdom wants us to make her a part of her life. And again, women readers are to identify with the son and respond to this request. But before we can respond, it's interesting that we get a second invitation, not from woman wisdom, but from another woman whose name is Folly, in chapter 9, verses 13 to 18. The woman named Folly is brash. She's ignorant and doesn't know it. She sits in her doorway on the heights overlooking the city. She calls out to men going by who are minding their own business. Come in with me, she urges the simple. To those who lack good judgment, she says, stolen water is refreshing. Food eaten in secret tastes the best. But little do they know that the dead are there. Her guests are in the depths of the grave. So there's another woman on another mountain who is inviting us to a meal. The narrator is telling us, warning us about accepting this invitation, because apparently her guests get killed and buried in the basement. But what Proverbs 9 is saying is that everybody has to make a decision. Will I dine with woman wisdom, or will I dine with woman folly? Who are these women? What do they represent? Now, turn to Proverbs 8. because Proverbs 8 describes woman wisdom. And this chapter, by the way, for reasons that I'll tell you in a bit, this chapter is one of the most misused chapters in the Bible. But here we get a description of woman wisdom. It says, listen as wisdom calls out, hear as understanding raises her voice, on the hilltop along the road. She takes her stand at the crossroads. By the gates at the entrance to the town, on the road leading in, she cries aloud. I call to you, to all of you. I raise my voice to all people. You simple people, use good judgment. You foolish people, show some understanding. Listen to me, for I have important things to tell you. Everything I say is right, for I speak the truth and detest every kind of deception. My advice is wholesome. There's nothing devious or crooked in it. My words are plain to anyone with understanding, clear to those with knowledge. Choose my instruction rather than silver, and knowledge rather than pure gold. For wisdom is more valuable than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with it. I, wisdom, live together with good judgment. I know where to discover knowledge and discernment. All who fear the Lord will hate evil. Therefore, I hate pride and arrogance, corruption and perverse speech. Common sense and success belong to me. Insight and strength are mine. So, you see, woman wisdom is a straight talker. She doesn't lie. She kind of embodies all the principles of the concept of wisdom. But pay special attention now to verses 15 and 16 when she says, because of me, kings reign and rulers make just decrees. Rulers lead with my help and nobles make righteous judgments. So she's saying that good rulers listen to me. They themselves are wise. Now I'm going to come back and make a connection from those two passages. He goes, I love all those who love me, and those who search will surely find me. I have riches and honor as well as enduring wealth and justice. My gifts are better than gold, even the purest gold. My wages better than sterling silver. I walk in righteousness and paths of justice. Those who love me inherit wealth. I will fill their treasuries. Now notice the connection here between woman wisdom and the rewards of wealth. And we'll have to come back and comment on this, that there seems to be a number of texts in Proverbs which seem to suggest that if you are wise, you're going to be wealthy, but if you are foolish, you're going to be poor. But we get into a especially fascinating section of the chapter in verse 22 and following when it describes the relationship between wisdom and creation. It says, the Lord formed me from the beginning, before he created anything else. I was appointed in ages past, at the very first, before the earth began. I was born before the oceans were created, before the springs bubbled forth their water. Before the mountains were formed, before the hills, I was born. Before he had made the earth and fields and the first handfuls of soil. I was there when he established the heavens, when he drew the horizon on the oceans. I was there when he set the clouds above, when he established springs deep in the earth. I was there when he set the limits of the seas, so they would not spread beyond their boundaries. And when he marked off the earth's foundation, I was the architect at his side. I was his constant delight, rejoicing always in his presence. And how happy I was with the world he created. How I rejoiced with the human family. So here, woman wisdom describes herself as essentially the firstborn of creation. She was there before the world was created. And one of the major points that is being made by this is that if wisdom was there while the earth was being created, then she knows how it works better than anybody else. So if you want to navigate life, then this is a woman you need to get to know. Then it ends with a admonition. And so, my children, listen to me, for all who follow my ways are joyful. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Don't ignore it. Joyful are those who listen to me, watching for me daily at my gates, waiting for me outside my home. Whoever finds me finds life and receives favor from the Lord. But those who miss me injure themselves. All who hate me love death. Okay, so who is Woman Wisdom? What does she represent? The key, in my opinion, comes from the location of her house. Her house is on the highest point of the city. In ancient Israel, indeed all throughout the ancient Near East, whose house was on the highest point of the city? What house was on the city? The temple, right? So Woman Wisdom is a poetic personification of Yahweh's wisdom, you know, treating an abstract quality as a person. But even more, she is Yahweh himself. She's Yahweh himself. So if she is Yahweh himself, who is Dame Folly? Notice where her house is, on the highest point of the city, where the temple is. So who is Folly? Folly represents the so-called wisdom, which is really foolishness, of idolatrous religion. She is a false god. And it represents, Proverbs 9 represents the choice the reader has to make between Yahweh and false gods. Now, what that does is it makes the very concepts of wisdom and folly theological. Wisdom is connected to righteousness and to godliness. Folly is connected to wickedness and to being ungodly. That means when we turn now to the second part of the book, 10 to 31, and we read the Proverbs, we see that there are far more than simply practical advice. They are theological statements. Proverbs 10:1, a wise son brings joy to a father, a foolish son brings grief to a mother. Reading it in the light of Proverbs 1 through 9, we kind of unpack it this way. If I am a child that brings joy to my parents, then I am wise, which means that I'm acting like a proper worshiper of Yahweh. But if I am bringing grief to my parents, then I'm a fool, which means I'm acting like an idolater. Okay, now that other one. Lazy people are soon poor. Hard workers get rich. Well, clearly, the proverb is trying to discourage laziness, as the Proverbs as a whole do, and encourage being a hard worker. So laziness is foolish behavior. Hard work is wise behavior. So again, if you're lazy, you're acting like an idolater. If you're a hard worker, then you're acting like a proper worshiper of Yahweh. And so forth and so on as you read the Proverbs. Now, so that's why I think the book of Proverbs is a deeply theological book. And it also is telling us, by the way, that wisdom, far from being the result of learning a lot of facts, is actually at its basis a relationship. To be wise is to be in relationship with Yahweh. To be in relationship with Yahweh is to listen to his words. To listen to his words, among other things, means to read the Proverbs, because the father and woman wisdom are a vehicle of Yahweh's advice to us. Now, before we go on and talk a little bit more about the nature of the proverb and how to interpret it, let's take a biblical theological look at the book of Proverbs. Let's ask the question, how do we read the book of Proverbs Christologically? Well, let me begin by saying the obvious, that is, the New Testament describes describes Jesus as preeminently wise. Remember the infancy narrative in Luke. We don't learn a lot about Jesus' youth, but what we learn is that he grew in stature and wisdom. That phrase is used twice at the end of chapter 2, framing an episode from Christ's youth, which describes the moment that the time that Mary and Joseph left Jesus behind at the temple. Remember that? They're walking home. Where's Jesus? We forgot him at the temple. They go back, and what is he doing? He is speaking to the rabbis, and the rabbis are amazed. You know, here the young Jesus is expressing God's wisdom. When Jesus begins to do his teaching, again, people are amazed. This one teaches like no other teacher. They're amazed at his wisdom. Notice that when he teaches, he uses a particular teaching form, the parable. The parable. The word parable in English is translated from the Greek word parabole. Parabole is the Greek word that is used to translate in the book of Hebrews the word mashal, which is proverb. The parabole is a distinctly wisdom teaching form. So as Jesus is going around teaching parables, everybody's going, this is a wise man. He's a chacham. So turning now to Paul. Paul in Colossians chapter 2, verse 3, has this to say about Jesus. He is the very treasure of God's wisdom. And, you know, at your leisure, you can read 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, which talks about the wisdom of Christ. So Paul and the Gospels are united in presenting Jesus as wise. But more than that, the New Testament associates Jesus with woman wisdom. It associates Jesus with woman wisdom, and it does so in the following way. In Matthew chapter 11, he's being harassed, as typical, by the Jewish leaders. And in this case, he's being harassed because they call him a drunkard, you know, and a feaster. And Jesus responds by saying, you know, you gave John a hard time for being one who was an ascetic or a faster. You're giving me a hard time. And at the end he goes, but wisdom will be proved right by her actions. It's a feminine possessive there, not its actions, but by her actions. He's associating himself with woman wisdom. Oh, that is Matthew chapter 11. Oh, 11:19. Thank you. 11:19. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15 and following is this magnificent poem, or maybe even hymn, where it says, concerning Jesus, Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is the firstborn of creation. Where's that language come from? Proverbs 8. He existed before anything was created, like woman wisdom. And he's the firstborn of creation, like woman wisdom. For through him, God created everything. And in Proverbs 8, lady wisdom or woman wisdom is more than an observer of wisdom. She is an agent of creation. In the heavenly realms and on earth, he made the things we can see and the things we can't see, such as, now notice this, thrones, kingdoms, rulers, and authority in the unseen world. Remember that phrase about woman wisdom and rulers. That's being reflected here in Colossians 1, verse 16. He existed before anything else, and he holds all creation together. Turn now to the famous John chapter 1, verse 1, and remember the language of Proverbs 8. In the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. You know, so again, this description of the Word, who of course is the Word made flesh, Jesus, is described in language that's drawn from Proverbs 8. There are other allusions as well, but I think I've made the point that the New Testament looks back on Proverbs 8 and associates woman wisdom with Jesus. Now notice, I'm really underlying the verb here, associates Jesus with woman wisdom, as opposed to identifies. You know, this is not a prophecy fulfillment pattern here. Jesus is not woman wisdom. Woman wisdom is not a prophecy of Jesus. Rather, the New Testament authors are associating Jesus with woman wisdom. The reason why I am underlying that is if you identify it and you think that woman wisdom is Jesus and you press the language literally, you will end up an Arian. You know, those of you who know church history know that Arius was a popular preacher, I think in the 3rd century A.D., who was going around saying, Jesus isn't God. He's a man, perfect man. And using Proverbs 8 as a proof text for that, because he was treating it literally, forgetting that it's a poem. And Athanasius and the other bishops gathered together and said, no go, that is not biblical truth. And so the early creeds, the Chalcedon, I think it's Chalcedon. You guys know your creeds probably better than I do. But it wasn't Chalcedon. It was one of those creeds. So, thank you, sir. And so, they reaffirmed the fact that Christ is fully God and fully man. And that's an important teaching. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact, especially as we now go back as Christians and read Proverbs 8, that as we think of this choice between woman wisdom and woman folly, we could think of it as a relationship with Jesus or a relationship with an idol. And we tend not to think of idols as Baal and Marduk, but rather as anything that we would put ahead of Jesus. You know, whether it be work or money or whatever. So if we put Jesus first, we're wise. If we put money or work first, then we're foolish. So that is, I think, an appropriate Christological reading of the book of Proverbs. With that said, now let's go back and ask about What do the Proverbs themselves teach us? As I said, is it really true that lazy people are soon poor, hard workers get rich? Is it even really true in every case that a wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son brings grief to his mother? Let me give you a scenario where I think Proverbs 10:1 is not true. You are an abused child of ungodly parents. And your parents tell you, you don't tell anyone how we're treating you. Otherwise, we will be very angry. Well, in that case, I think it's appropriate not to bring joy to your parents. Or I'll give you even a concrete example. My wife, after I met her, she had just become a Christian in high school. Her parents thought that she had become a fanatic. She had become a Christian, not a fanatic. She was invited to go to Bible studies with her new Christian friends who were seminary students at Westminster Seminary. That's how I got to know about Westminster when I met her. One of them is now a famous New Testament scholar named Andrew Lincoln, who teaches at Sheffield. And when Andrew and his wife Paula would call up and invite her over for Bible study, they said, "You cannot go." And once my father-in-law was so angry, he actually ripped the phone out of the socket. But she still went, and she made them very unhappy, did not bring them any joy, but she did the right thing. You know, in that case, she did the right thing. So what is the deal? You see, the proverb is a particular type of genre where it is expressing a truth, but not a universally valid truth. It's not a kind of truth that's true in every situation, but rather it's the kind of truth that's true when applied to the right circumstance. They're not always true. Let me give you another kind of personal homey anecdote here. My grandmother actually loved Proverbs, and she always talked in Proverbs. And on our Thanksgiving Day, when my family and my aunt's family would come down to have a big turkey dinner, which is our custom, my mother and my aunt would go into the kitchen, and my grandmother would greet her with the English proverb, "Too many cooks spoil the broth." And what she meant by that is, get out of my kitchen, I'm making it my way, right? But then after dinner, after, you know, we have this big dinner and there are now 200 dirty dishes, my grandmother would come into the room and speak to us, her grandchildren, and say, many hands make light work, you know, which is get in here, we're all pitching in to clean the dishes. See, those two proverbs are in principle in conflict with each other. But we couldn't stand up and say, "Grandma, make up your mind." Because, you see, one was true in one circumstance, the other was true in another circumstance. Of course, turn to Proverbs 26, verse 4 and 5. Proverbs 26, verse 4. Says, "Do not answer the foolish arguments of fools, or you will become as foolish as they are." Followed in the very next verse with, "Answer the foolish arguments of fools, or they will become wise in their own situation." You know, your first response might be, "Thanks for the advice," you know. But if you understand what a proverb is, then you realize you can't just know the proverb. You have to become wise to read a situation. And in some situations, you just know when somebody comes up to you and wants to argue that all you're going to do is waste your breath because they're not going to even listen to you. My father should have learned that with my grandfather, who once told him, even if I'm wrong, I'm right. In other words, and with that type of person, of course, my grandfather didn't do that with everybody, just his son-in-law. But in other times, either the person, you know, you might be able to convince the person, or maybe if you can't convince them, there are other people around that you can have. So you read the situation. In other words, you need to know the right time to do the right thing, to say the right thing. This is a wisdom principle. We'll see it in Ecclesiastes as well in a slightly different way. Turn to Proverbs 26, verse 7. Proverbs 26:7 says, a proverb in the mouth of a fool is like having a paralyzed leg. So what's that saying? It's saying a fool may know the proverbs, but since they don't know how to apply it right, it's as useless as a paralyzed leg. But even more dramatic is verse 9, a proverb in the mouth of a fool is like a thorny branch brandished by a drunk. You see, the proverbs often express its truth using kind of interesting imagery, and we're to picture a drunk person with a thorn bush, blood running down their hand, maybe inflicting injury on other people around. And so this proverb is saying, a fool may know the proverbs, but since they don't know how to apply it in the right time, they're going to do damage. It's worse than useless. So timing is everything in Proverbs. That's, again, what we're doing here is asking, how are the Proverbs meant to be interpreted and applied? It's a genre question. A second part of that genre question, and with this I'll be concluding and taking your questions. Again, I'm kind of giving you principles for the right reading of the book of Proverbs. It has to do with the rewards and punishments associated with the Proverbs. Now, we're going to see that this issue of retribution, people getting what they deserve, is going to be a major one in the Bible, and we'll continue with this theme in Ecclesiastes. But a lot of people read the Proverbs wrongly, as if they are giving promises. Promises. Let me take a classic example, which is, I always forget which verse it is because I never look it up. But you all know it, and probably some of you know where to find it, so I'll just say it. The proverb is, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he grows old, he will not depart from it. You probably all heard that proverb. And it's telling the reader a certain course of behavior and indicating the consequence of that behavior. You, parent, train up the child in the way he should go, and when he grows old, he will not depart from it. And that's sometimes used as a promise. You know, somebody who has an older child who goes wrong, you know, you might go up and say, you know, don't worry about it. God has promised that this child will return. That is, unfortunately, a misuse of this proverb. First of all, I should point out that it's not immediately clear how we should translate the proverb, because the proverb literally says, train up a child in his way, and when he grows old, he will not depart from it. So train up a child in his way. So there's one type of interpretation that says, since the immediate antecedent to his way is the child, you know, train up a child in the child's way. And when he grows old, he won't depart from it. Meaning that if you have a child with a certain bent, you know, learns better one way or the other, that's the one you should use because that's the most effective way. Now, the problem with that interpretation is that Proverbs understands that wickedness is bound up in the heart of a child. So if you train up a child according to the child's bent, that's going to be a problem. And that's why there is an interpretive tradition which says, train up a child in the child's way, and when he grows old, he won't depart from it, much to your regret. Because that's not the way you're supposed to raise your child. But I think that since the book of Proverbs as a whole, always when it says his way or talks about the way, or in a positive sense, it's referring to God's way. So I do think it's right to translate it. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he grows old, he won't depart from it. But as I say, it's not a guarantee. What it is, what a proverb does, is that it tells you the proper action to achieve a proper, to achieve a desired end, all other things being equal. That is, you parent, this is your responsibility. And if you do it, then you'll have done what you need to do for the child to reach a good end. But it's not guaranteeing that, you know, some peers will come along and lead them in a bad direction. The proverbs are not guarantees. Lazy people are soon poor. Hard workers get rich. Is true probably 99% of the time, but the 1% of the time that you have, well, at least on the laziness part, you have the Paris Hilton. That doesn't disqualify the truth of the proverb. It's probably less often true on the other side, you know, hard workers get rich. Because sometimes you work really hard and something comes along. Matter of fact, there's a proverb in Proverbs 13 that talks about, you know, a poor person works really hard, but then an injustice comes along and takes it all away. So the Proverbs themselves recognize that you can work really hard, but forces beyond your control, whether it's a storm that destroys your crops or a evil bureaucrat who exploits you, is not true all the time. But still, this is wisdom. It is the best advice to achieve a desired end, all other things being equal. Now, you know, I feel when I talk about this sometimes and point it out to people, I feel kind of like the person who steals candy from a baby. You know, it's kind of like, and I do know people who take comfort in this when their child goes astray. The problem is that if you treat these rewards and punishments as if they are promises, you will end up like one of the three friends of Job. In other words, rather than using it as a term of comfort, it will be used as an instrument of judgment of others. Oh, look, their child is in jail. They must not have raised them right. You know, or in the case of Job, look at Job. He's suffering horribly. Clearly, he has sinned greatly. But such readings of Proverbs and wisdom literature in general are a misreading. Because Proverbs itself is, first of all, by virtue of the form of the proverb, not making promises. And then you have a whole genre of parallelisms in the book of Proverbs that we call better than proverbs. There are better than proverbs scattered throughout the book that give relative values and will often say something like, better to be poor with love than rich with strife. You know, so it's basically these kind of proverbs are saying, you know, not everybody who's wise is rich. Sometimes you have to make a decision. Will I be rich or will I be wise? But people kind of skip over those, especially in the United States. We have a type of preacher that we refer to as prosperity preachers, you know. Have faith in God because God wants to give you lots of money and heal you from your sicknesses. And they're picking up and often proof texts from the book of Proverbs. Well, those are a few comments on sort of how to read the book of Proverbs that illustrate some of the points we made this morning about the importance of genre, the Christological reading of the text, and other issues as well. But I see now that it's about 7:30, but I'd love to take questions for about 10 minutes. Yes. Yeah. That's right. I mean, what I would say about those proverbs is, you know, some people treat that as law. And I have actually been around, and by the way, that's a distinction to make. Proverbs, wisdom, are not the same genre as law. You know, the Ten Commandments in their Old Testament context are always true. I mean, it's not like you must not commit adultery is only true in the right circumstance, you know, that there are circumstances where adultery is okay. No. Law in the Ten Commandments, and also the case law, actually, in its Old Testament setting, are always true. But I have actually been with people, not a lot, fortunately, that felt that spare the rod was a law, which meant that if a child misbehaved, you had to spank them. Even if the child is repenting and changing their behavior without physical punishment. And I remember having lunch with a pastor and another couple where the other couple was practicing this consistently, and the kid must have been spanked 55 times during lunch, but it was ridiculous, you know. Now, on the other hand, I would not, and I know I'm in Sweden, maybe I better be careful, because there are actually articles about it's against the law to spank kids here, right? And I saw I wish I had read it now. My colleague had printed out, there's been a kind of sociological study of, you know, the effect of that law, whether it's helped or hurt child raising. I don't know. I could have said it's great. But in the Old Testament context, I mean, there was the practice of physical discipline, but we hear rod and we think, you know, wailing away. But that's not, you know, the book of Proverbs talks about doing everything in moderation and to the proper amount. If somebody actually physically abused somebody in the act of discipline, they would be considered a fool in the eyes of Proverbs. So, I know that. So, but you're exactly right that to sort of apply that legalistically and mechanistically and literally is wrong. Yes. Ah, yeah. 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 I would radically disagree with your professor on that. As I will make clear tomorrow with Ecclesiastes too, because, you know, he would also, and some scholars will make that a tension between Job and Ecclesiastes and Proverbs. Now I do think, as I'll explain tomorrow with Ecclesiastes, that Job and Ecclesiastes are warning toward a misreading of Proverbs. You know, as I said, you can read Proverbs wrongly as if it's making guarantees, and not recognizing the better than Proverbs. And by the way, I tell your professor to read the wonderful article in Hebrew Studies by Raymond Van Leeuwen on this subject. And so you can read it that way. And so Job and Proverbs are there to remind you that retribution doesn't always work out the way a literalistic reading suggests. Now, I should also say, just briefly, reading about retribution in the Old Testament from the New Testament perspective, in the New Testament we get a broader perspective. I mean, in the long run, in the end, it does work out. Not in this life, but in the next. So we have to take a kind of eschatological view on this. Any other? And I'll make this argument in my Job commentary too, which I hope he reads when it comes out. Yes. Yeah, you know, I don't think so. You know, and of course it is, it's not that the book of Proverbs is completely divorced from the religious institutions of Israel, but it's kind of a minimal theme. There is some talk of sacrifice in it, but Leo Perdue has written a book on the Israelite cult in the biblical books of Proverbs, and he deals with the handful of articles that deal with that. I mentioned sacrifice, of course, because that was a vehicle of atonement in the Old Testament. But again, no individual book teaches all of Old Testament theology as well. Maybe one or two more questions, then we'll call it an evening, or maybe we should call it an evening and be refreshed tomorrow.